That wraps it up for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For previous episodes, go to kpfa.org or flashpoints.net. For questions or comments, email dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
Tune in to KBOO every Friday at 6 p.m. from September 15th to October 15th for KBOO's Hispanic Heritage Month series. Join KBOO in celebrating and paying tribute to the contributions and enriching influences of Hispanic and Latinx Americans and their ancestors. You'll hear from volunteer producers from Buscando America, Boogie Pachanguero, Noticias en Español, and more. Again, that's KBOO's Hispanic Heritage Month series, every Friday at 6 p.m. from September 15th to October 15th, here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
During our fall membership drive, KBOO is exploring the sounds of democracy. We are taking a deep dive in democracy in all its forms. From current events to music and culture, KBOO is your community connection. Support KBOO and get your own limited edition Sounds of Democracy t-shirt at kboo.fm right now.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience. KBOO, Portland.
I am Suzanne LeGrand, and this is Radio Z. Today, my guests are science historian and writers Anna Reeser and Layla McNeil, who has just co-written Forces of Nature, The Women Who Changed Science. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you. It's nice to be here.
When I studied history and science, it seemed that it was mainly the story of men who were making scientific discoveries. And the only woman scientist I ever heard mentioned was Marie Curie. Could you tell us first why you wrote this book and also about some of the women scientists we may not have heard of?
Yeah, so Anna and I went through the same graduate program in history of science, and our experience in learning the history of science, even at the grad level, was very similar to yours. It was mainly the march of progress spurred on by the works of great men. Anything that we did learn about women in the history of science was largely done on our own, things that we learned and found. The more that we looked on our own, the more women that we found. And we also had the great pleasure of being in a program that was associated with Marilyn Ogilvie, who in the 1970s, she kind of was one of the women historians who kind of spearheaded the movement to document women in the history of science. And she did a lot of that groundwork to even find out the names of these women, when they were born, where they lived, when they died, stuff like that. We didn't even know for a lot of these women until the 1970s. One thing that you'll find in our book is that Marie Curie is mentioned once at the very end, explaining why we don't talk about her in the rest of the book. And part of that is because there were just so many other women that are worth knowing about and worth learning about. And they are kind of overshadowed in our public imagination by figures like Marie Curie. Not to say that Marie Curie was not an extraordinary person who did extraordinary things, but the history of science is so much richer than the works of individuals, even individual women. Women have been participating in science in ways that don't look like the ways Marie Curie did. and that they've been doing it since ancient period and the Middle Ages. We wanted to shine a light on other women that you might not have heard about, where there's far fewer resources to find out about them.
Could you tell me about some of the women scientists that you found in your research that perhaps listeners may not have heard about?
One of my favorite chapters is about women archaeologists and anthropologists, particularly women of color who became anthropologists and archaeologists specifically so that they could better understand the history of their own cultures outside of the sort of white colonial gaze that had to that point been applied. So one person in particular that I am really fascinated by is Zelia Nuttall, who's a Mexican-American archaeologist, and her study of indigenous Mexican people really changed the narrative in Mexico that had been kind of laid over by this sort of colonial study of ancient Mexico, that, you know, ancient Mexicans were primitive and savages and that their culture was inferior in all these ways. And her research actually helped to change those narratives in Mexico itself among Mexican people about their own ancestors. There is a colonial tradition that has been overturned in some places by people working on their own heritage, and in this case, women who didn't have university degrees because it was basically completely infeasible for them to get one, who set out to do this work out of a sense of obligation to their own cultures and to make sure that people understood that real history there and that people couldn't use those narratives to marginalize people anymore. And so I think Zelia Nuttall is one of those people that I'm really fascinated by.
You know, you hit upon one of the reasons why many of us may not have heard of some of these women scientists, which is that historically many women have not had access to formal education or to places where history has been recorded formally. What are some of the other reasons why women may not have been included in the history of science?
So you have the erasure that comes from the way science has been structured, that you do have those kind of, you know, very tangible institutional barriers that don't allow women into the spaces where scientific discoveries and innovation are recorded, where they take down the names of the people who enter these halls. You know, that is one way that people have legacies, is the way that they are recorded in the institutions of their time. You know, when women aren't allowed there, that is one form of erasure that we find. Another form of erasure is the historical process and historical analysis. Okay, so us historians, we didn't find women on this roster of women in the Royal Society. Ergo, women were not participating in science. That is another form of erasure. Instead of kind of going a little bit further and being a little bit more critical of that and asking, well, one, why weren't they there? Why weren't they allowed there? And if they weren't there, are we just going to assume that they didn't do science, they didn't do medicine, they weren't involved in, you know, the scientific culture of their time? And a lot of the times the answer has come up, well, no, I guess they didn't. But what we find is that they did. And it does take kind of turning away and looking in other areas of study to find how women and where women were participating in science. What we find is women doing science in the home, integrating innovation into their everyday lives. We also find women who were publishing scientific works, especially in the 19th century, but weren't publishing in scientific journals. They were publishing in the public sphere. The way, you know, kind of popular science is not considered necessarily proper science, and that has been somewhat ignored when we look at, women's participation in science. So there's all of these kind of different layers of erasure that have happened over time that have kind of kept women out of like our gaze for looking at the history of science.
Just to pick up on that as well, like Layla said, that you know, publishing in the public sphere or doing science that is more publicly oriented is often not considered science, and so therefore not in the purview of historians of science. But I think inside science itself, we do see like explicit ways that science is defined in order to exclude certain people. If a science or a technical field, the sort of best example of that would be computing in the 20th century, is seen as feminized, then it cannot by its nature as being feminine be science. So women who were programming the very first computers, their work was seen as something more like needlework than scientific work, and they were doing just grunt work, calculations and solving equations and all this stuff that men needed someone else to do so that they could do the high-minded thinking. We see this too in places like the Harvard Observatory, where women computers and calculators are looking at glass plates and cataloging stars and doing all the math, and the men are the ones that are on the telescope taking the observing time, and the work that women are doing is not in that time considered scientific. It's just considered like the ancillary labor that goes along with this. And so expanding our purview means interrogating also who defines what is science in certain times and places, and how those definitions get constructed. And we find that in a lot of cases, they get constructed specifically so that women can't get paid as much as men, so that women can't have as much status as men, so that women can't get into societies and all the various kind of like laurel granting institutions of science.
Do you think that's changed at present?
I think yes and no. Yes and but. I think that in some institutions, there has been a greater awareness to these more microaggressive ways that women's work is demeaned. I don't think that there has been an overall reckoning of scientific culture that investigates that. I think that it is still very much on the shoulders of women within institutions to raise that awareness, which isn't really fair. I mean, women throughout history have been carrying the onus of this, and they're continuing to do so. And we still find just the plain everyday sexism of women still being the primary caregivers at home, which takes away from the time that they're able to spend in a lab. And that those types of, I mean, women used to be denied university professorships or admission into grad school because the assumption was that they were going to get married. We don't blatantly do that anymore, but there's still the uneven allocation of domestic work that women still own that takes away from the time that they're able to put into research. And I think that's something that we really saw over the course of the pandemic. And I think just a few months ago, there was like one thing where like women had published absolutely no papers in scientific journals during a month and men had. So, I mean, like even stuff like that, even if it's not baked into the rules of an institution, it's still very much within the culture of science and our culture at large that kind of separates women's work from men's work. And that has overall impacts on the way women are able to participate in science.
Yeah, it's also still true that there are more women in so-called soft sciences than there are in hard sciences. And it's because they generally have an easier time getting into those fields because they're not as exclusive. Like the culture of like high energy physics has been sort of in the news in the last few years as just being pretty toxic. And there's this expectation also that like their gendered expectations about what kind of science women could be interested in, like the life sciences are better suited to women. That kind of thing is like straight out of the 19th century, and no one ever says it out loud, of course, but the numbers back it up, and like we still have these kind of fragmented disciplinary divisions that are based on gender and these kinds of leftover Victorian ideas that are still just kind of bubbling under the surface. And I think that talking about them and where they come from and the history of those ideas is really important, because we don't say those things out loud. You know, that's the quiet part, and we want to say the quiet part out loud.
So I want to go back just a little bit in our discussion to talk about the fact that a lot of times women were doing things that were not considered the purview of science. And one example that I think you give is the fact that women practiced medicine and oftentimes had quite a bit of knowledge about medicinal use of herbs, for example. But that was not considered the practice of medicine as it was practiced in that time period. It was considered folk medicine, right? So that would be one example of where women were active in doing what we would consider today scientific work, but it was given a different name than what counted as science.
Right. And this is one of those instances where it was an expectation that women did the care work for their families and the communities. And that did involve things like coming up with medicinal recipes that they would hand down to the next woman in their family, that a lot of that knowledge was handed down orally. And that was one of the ways that women's knowledge about medicine and the body was kind of codified. And that's not something that we consider within the purview of science because, you know, it's not written down in a journal. One thing that we really find in medicine is that when it started to become professionalized in the 19th century, is really when the work of women as kind of lay physicians within their communities became demeaned as quackery or anything that kind of fell outside of what was being taught in the universities that only men were allowed in coincidentally. And everything outside of that was no longer medicine. None of that was proper anymore. It was just plain quackery. And so the professionalization of medicine really changed the way people saw the role of women in caring for the sick. And that is something that I think in going into the 20th century, we haven't really fully reckoned with as well, that we don't really understand how the professionalization of medicine kind of relegated women to the margins. That professionalization has shaped medicine as we know it in the 20th and 21st century.
But also, I think the example that you gave of the fact that when women did get scientific training, the jobs that they were given tended to be low-level jobs that did not recognize their contributions to science or didn't give them the opportunity to do scientific research independent of the men that they largely worked for, right?
Yeah, I think this is something that we cover in a couple of different chapters that focus on the 20th century, that the emergence of big science, of these large-scale projects that take a lot of staff, is kind of a double-edged sword for women, because the project managers and investigators are seeing, well, we need a lot of people to do all these calculations or look at all of these glass plates or do all of this paperwork for the Manhattan Project or whatever it is, mixing up plutonium in open containers. And so we can pay less if we hire women. So in the case of like the Harvard Observatory, this is a moment when there are women's colleges and people, and there are more women with college education. And so these positions are opening up for women to work in their field and to use their training, but they are sort of explicitly opening up under this kind of big science economics of, we have to hire a bunch of people and we have to hire them as cheaply as possible. We cannot pay men what we would pay women. And that's true all across the economy in, you know, in the West at this time too. If you're working in a factory or something, women are always getting paid less. So it's this like strange moment where there are these big large-scale scientific projects that need a lot of staff, and people are actually having opportunities to use their training and to go into science and work in a lab, but they're getting paid a lot less. They have much lower status. They're usually getting like massively overworked, and they don't have an opportunity to author papers or be recognized really in any way, because they're just doing this kind of grunt work. And I think when we sort of extrapolate that to our present day, we have to remember that that is the legacy of, at least in this country, in the United States, that is the like foundational image of science. So you have a big lab with a primary investigator, and you hire a bunch of people to do all of this work, and everybody's given a specialized job. And the root of this culture that we still have, that is still the structure of how science is done on every university campus, in every private biotech firm, comes from this gendered way of doing labor. And so people can have all the like diversity and inclusion statements they want. They can say whatever they want publicly about who they hire. Like Layla said, I don't think that we have reckoned with that being the underlying structure, the underlying kind of root legacy of scientific culture and the work culture in science that we still have today.
Universities are one place where scientific investigations occur, but 75% of college faculty are adjuncts, which means low paid, primarily teachers, and most of those are women and people of color, which means that 25% of the jobs that are left for tenure track jobs where somebody might be able to do scientific research tend to be occupied by white men. Mm-hmm. So in some sense, what you're talking about with respect to, you know, computers in the mid 20th century and women doing low paid grunt work for scientists who then are able to theorize, is really not that different than the situation, it seems, of at least structurally, of universities at present. Do you think that's true? Is my observation correct in thinking that there's a connection between those two?
Yeah, I absolutely think that there is. Like what I said earlier, even if institutions legally cannot have in their, you know, stated, written down somewhere that women aren't allowed to do this, you know, like they used to in the 19th century and before that, they've just found different ways to relegate women to the margins and to low-ranking positions with not the possibility of a lot of career advancement. One of the issues that arises as well when we look at women in the sciences today and how women are underrepresented, and that it's not just an issue of role models, it's that when you have the majority of these leadership positions and people in power that are kind of, you know, white men, that they themselves have probably not investigated their participation in toxic cultures in science of racism and sexism. And that those types of things determine who stays in science, who's going to stick it out with these men and who's not.
As an adjunct myself, the casualization of the workforce in academia, I think, is a great analog to think about these two things together. I'm still teaching the same classes that TT faculty would be teaching, but I get paid way less for it because it's just been recategorized somehow. And then you're in a lecture pool with a bunch of other people who are not getting paid very much. Same thing as the like pool of computers or the bullpen.
And you're paid to teach, not to do scientific research yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. That way, the PIs and the rock star professors can do that without having to worry about covering those classes.
There's a third way that you mentioned that women have been erased in the history of science, and it's connected to the fact that they oftentimes have been given the role of assistants, and that is that their work has not been recognized and in fact also has often been stolen and claimed by male colleagues. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so one of the things that we write about in the book, we have a chapter on wives assistants and sisters, and these are women who were able to participate in science by way of their relationship with a famous man. So we talk about Elizabetha Hevelius. We talk about Carolyn Herschel, sister to William Herschel. Talk about Lady Ranelagh, who I think is maybe the less known of all of them, who was sister to Robert Boyle. How these women were very much hands-on with the work of their male partner. And a lot of times in that time period, their husband or brother welcomed the assistance that they offered and relied on it heavily to make their work happen. When we get the final published work from this, you know, sometimes years-long collaboration between husband and wife or sister and brother, that it is the man's name that appears as author, which was common practice at the time. A lot of times we don't know if a wife was participating unless the husband mentions it in the published work. In the case of Lady Ranelagh and Robert Boyle, he references her by a nickname that if you aren't reading that closely, you don't know who he's talking about. And so we think that because of the ways that we had to kind of, and other historians have had to try to kind of pull apart the contributions of women from their male partner and how difficult that can be, just because sometimes they aren't named, is that that's probably a much wider phenomenon in history than we even have record of wives helping husbands and never getting the credit for that.
Another astronomer that is really interesting too is Vera Rubin. And there's a great, well, I don't know, it's not a great story. It's kind of a terrible story, but the way she tells it is great, about giving a presentation about her research about dark matter, where she uncovered the first evidence of this. And she had a young child at the time, and her advisor was like, oh, well, you clearly can't go to this conference and present your research. I would be happy to present it for you, but if I do, I'm going to put my name on it and present it as though it were my own. And Vera Rubin took her kids to the conference and presented, and now she is quite well known, and deservedly so. But I think one of the things that really surprised Layla and I when we were working on this book, just in general for all periods, is just how shameless. I mean, men in the 19th century wrote everything down. Every bad thought they ever had about any woman they ever encountered, they wrote it down. But even Vera Rubin's advisor just very shamelessly saying, I'll present your work for you. I'm going to put my name on it, though.
I'm wondering how the practice of science changes by who does the science.
One of the ways that women got involved in local and national politics around the environment was by making the argument that we are uniquely situated to speak on this issue because we are women who raise children. We are housewives that take care of our home. Our home also encompasses the city and our community, and beyond that, our state and our nation. And so it was really a clever move to kind of redefine what the home is so that they could expand their space out into national politics. And this is an instance in which the knowledge that they have just going through their daily lives really shaped a national conversation about food purity laws, water purity. All of those things were started by women. And I think the environmentalism issue is a great example to pull out from the book to demonstrate how the person doing the observing, doing the experimenting, can really shape the knowledge that we have about nature and about science.
And also, I would add, what's considered worth investigating.
Absolutely, yes. Absolutely.
Right. So gender does really shape scientific agendas.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
Absolutely.
What do you hope that readers will take away from reading Forces of Nature, The Women Who Changed Science?
Well, to come back to something that Layla said just kind of in passing at the very beginning, is that the history of science is so much richer than just the biographies of individuals, even individual women, because I think it tells us so much about the way we live and where we come from and who we are, because science is such an integral part of our day-to-day lives now.
Yeah, I guess for me, one of the things I hope readers will take away from this book is understanding that the culture and institution of science has the power to shape our modern world, and that if we want to build a better modern world, then we need to investigate the past to understand how science has been built. And that includes coming to terms with the ways that it has been sometimes an oppressive force in people's lives. And that if we want to create a better science, a more ethical science, then it does need to become less homogenous. It needs to become more democratic and more equal. And that's one of the lessons that I hope people will take from reading this book.
Today on Disobedient Femmes, my guests have been Anna Reeser and Layla McNeil, who have just published Forces of Nature, The Women Who Changed Science. For listeners who are interested in learning more about your work, where can they go?
You can find me on Twitter at Anna N. Reeser. Yeah, that's probably the best place to find me. Yeah.
Well, and we also have a website for the book as well, which is forcesofnaturebook.com. And I have a website, which is laylamcneil.com. And that links to all of the work that I have put out on the internet, including links to the magazine and podcast that Anna and I run together, ladyscience.com. Yeah.
I am Suzanne LeGrand, and this is KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM in Portland. And this is Radio Z. I am Suzanne LeGrand, and this is Radio Z. Today, my guest is Dr. Rosalind Byrne, who is an ethics scholar, equine empath, and author of When Horses Whisper, The Wise Wisdom of Sentient Beings. And she also has a follow-up book, Waking to Beauty, Encounters with Remarkable Beings. To begin, I would like to ask you about your work with horses. How did you become a horse whisperer?
Well, it certainly wasn't an intention. I was actually on a writing retreat in Costa Rica working on a sci-fi novel, and I wanted to take a break from being in the cabin indoors, so I took a trail ride. And while on that ride, I actually fell off of my horse into the water, the River Arenal. When I got back on the horse, it's like some channel opened in my mind and I heard the horse, and we engaged in a conversation, and that's where it began.
You write, "To hear horses whisper is much like hearing an answer to a prayer. And in both cases, we have to trust and believe what we hear with our mind's ear. When we move into a state of deep connection to the unity of life, language falls away." Mm. So lovely. Mm. How is it in this noisy world that we live in, you have found that place of deep connection?
I wish it was always with me. I'm afraid it's fleeting. There are ways to cultivate it. That's what I have discovered. So that time in Costa Rica, I was alone in the rainforest, in a cabin, and meditating morning and evening while I was writing. And I think it just got me into a quiet inner space. When I go out to see horses and to work with them, I have to go into that place so that I can hear them. For me, at least, it's not simply always on, especially in the last year where things have been so intense and chaotic, and I've been on my screen 10, 12 hours a day for my livelihood on email and focused outwardly and not taking time for turning back in. And so I would say, it's something I deeply crave to maintain it and cultivate it, but it takes some work.
One of the things I appreciated was that communication with horses was by mutual agreement, and not all horses wanted to talk to humans. What did you learn about mutual respect and the conditions that are needed for true communication between animals and humans?
The most important lesson I had about that came from a horse named Juano, who was a stallion I met in Costa Rica. And when I first met Juano, I was so taken with him, his beauty, his power, his stature, really taken with him. And so the day after I met him, I went back to the barn looking for him excitedly. And I walked up to a horse I thought was Juano and started talking to him about how grateful I was to meet him. And I turned around, and indeed, another horse across the other side of the barn was staring at me. And I had this sinking feeling, uh-oh. And then I realized that was Juano on the other side of the barn, not the horse I was talking to. So I went to approach him, and he really scolded me. Just, "Who do you think you are coming in here, acting like you're special? You can't even recognize us. We're all different. And until you figure that out and you learn who we are as individuals, don't bother coming in here. We're not interested." It was quite painful and stunning at the same time, because I realized how right he was. I had presumed, and I hadn't taken the care to truly respectfully recognize and honor the individuals that each of these horses might be. And of course, not being too hard on myself, you know, sometimes it's hard to distinguish one person from another. I teach 35 students in a classroom. Sometimes it takes me a while to figure out who's who. Mm-hmm. But I realized because of what I'm asking of them to connect with me on the level that I do, it's my responsibility to do that in honor of them. So I try really hard now to know the name and recognize the markings so I can know exactly who I'm with and address that individual horse.
You talk about how horses can heal humans emotionally. Can you just describe briefly what some of those ways are?
Well, horses are heart-centered beings. They pump more blood per minute from their hearts. I don't remember, I don't want to be inaccurate, but it's some very significantly more than we do. And relative to their brains, the hearts are just, they're just larger. So when they sense us and each other, part of what they do uses the heart in a way that we haven't really been cultivating as humans. We tend to be more brain-centered, right? And so because they're heart-centered and because of their senses, they can sense what's going on with us in our own hearts. And that's why they're so helpful for healing, because they can feel what's going on in our own hearts. And I would say for most of us, we have broken hearts.
I think it was Titan, one of the first horses you encountered. He said, "We are here for growth of our consciousness just as humans are." Could you talk a little bit about horses' vision of themselves?
Yes, and I will, to your point, say that they don't all hold that awareness. Just like with humans, some of us are oriented towards, I would say, spiritual consciousness, and some of us are oriented towards daily, mundane, three-dimensional living. I feel that I'm learning a lot still, Suzanne. I'm learning so much. And there's a lot I don't understand. But what I'm coming to is that humans as a species, horses as a species, probably other living species, are all in a process of evolving as individuals, but also as a whole. And so I tuned into something I started referring to as soul of horse, which is the larger life force, which is the horse soul that then comes into being in individuals, but that the whole is evolving through the experiences of individuals. And I think that's what's happening with humans as well.
Mm. Oh, that's fascinating. We are all becoming more collectively connected, right?
And I think we all already are, but we don't remember that. And so our experiences as individuals and then in collective, hopefully help us to remember that over time.
Your follow-up book, Waking to Beauty, Encounters with Remarkable Beings, you include a lot of personal stories about your own life and some of the personal challenges you have had to deal with. And you state in your introduction that this is not what you initially intended to do. Why was it important to include your own story in telling the story about your work with horses?
Because people were asking me, how can you do this? Where does this come from? Is this something all people can do, or is this something only some people could do? And I didn't have answers to those questions. And so in order to sort of come to my own understanding about it, I had to think about my own life and the evolution of my own capacities for communication sort of beyond the standard, the norm. And so I started digging around and thinking about, well, yeah, in fact, in childhood, I was communicating with people that had already passed on. So maybe there's something that started early for me. And so then the book started to write itself, I suppose, as the more I thought about experiences in my life, the more I could connect the dots to indications that maybe the capacity was in me to be able to do this. To my surprise, actually, the book ends with me out on a lake that I happen to be visiting right now, looking at a loon. And taking me back to that sense that we are connected and that all of us, not just human to human, but human to all living species, all of life in its various forms, and that the capacity to communicate with life is just part of that connection. And so the process of writing Waking to Beauty was a process of waking, it's a sort of double entendre, to the beauty of what I was learning through the horses, but also through considering my life experiences.
When I think about communicating with animals and that sense of true connection, it comes with a lot of pain. And in your book, you communicate with horses, and some of the stories they tell are unfortunately about being abused at the hands of humans and what that's like. There's one story that I found particularly heart-wrenching and horrific, which was about the mare being forcibly impregnated. I'm wondering how it is that you hear these stories and are able to bear them, I guess, knowing how mistreated animals are in this world.
Well, Suzanne, there's the direct experience of being in the presence of a horse that's sharing this, and the heartbreak of that. And then there's the philosophical, you know, position, which is probably how I survive, of this seems to be the nature of life. These stories about how we've treated animals have also been the stories about how we've treated other human beings. Mm-hmm. And so I don't understand why there is so much cruelty in the living experience of humans. I don't understand where it comes from or why it's necessary. I don't have an answer, but I am glad to have a heart that can feel it. Right? And so, and I'm glad to be able to hear the horses so I can share their stories with the people who are responsible for them and hope that they can hear them and change their relationships. That's what why else would this gift have come, you know, if I can't in some way make life better for some of these animals? And I hope I have been able to.
You are a scholar in ethics. What questions does that lead you, or should it lead us, to think about in terms of our relationship with animals?
For a long time, until very recently, actually, compartmentalizing my work as an ethics scholar, because I work in engineering ethics, right? So I look at technology in the future, but also sort of some of the current issues around engineering. And that world is such a cut and dry world. It's such a black and white world. And sometimes I feel like I'm traveling in a foreign country every time I go to work, because I see the world so differently. But I've also been anxious about sharing this part of myself in that world, right? Because I'm trying to maintain my reputation as a scholar. And so I compartmentalize. And so, you know, I'm publishing in the body, mind, spirit domain, and I'm keeping that separate from the other because I don't know how to unite them. And then a few years ago, I spoke with a fellow ethicist. I told him the story, and he said, "You have to write about that. You have to in the academic world." And I thought, how can I do that? Fortunately, there are people starting to do it. And I was asked only recently to give a talk, which is coming up next week, for an American Society of Engineering Managers. And I said, "What do you want me to talk about?" And they said, "Interspecies communication." And I thought, oh my gosh, the universe is now telling me, step it up, kiddo. Step it up and bring these together. Now, that's the long answer. The short answer is that they are linked. They're linked because once we begin to acknowledge and accept and really, really see that animals are aware, they're conscious, they're sentient, they're communicative, they communicate across the boundaries of species, then how do we continue to behave the way we do? How do we do that ethically? And so now what I think we have to do is we have to rethink what we consider to be ethics in engineering practice, what we consider to be ethics in the way we live, not just in the professions, but in our personal lives. If that information is available to us, how do we justify it unless we continue to consider other species to be much less significant than us and much less valuable than us? But how do you do that when you learn what I've learned? How do you do that when it turns out that you're looking into the eyes, when I'm looking at a horse, of another living being who is aware, intelligent, conscious, and communicative, and has feelings? How do you do that? So I think I've changed. Not that I was abusive or anything, but now I have to live differently.
I mean, when you say live differently, like in what way do you feel like you need to do something different?
Oh, well, this is really funny. So in some ways, it's something as simple as acknowledging and saying hello to a dog when I walk by them on the street, right? Mm-hmm, because it's like, that's another being. Pay your respects. Say hello. but it's also having a struggle with, you know, I put on my leather shoes and now I say, thank you. to the life force, the life form that made it possible for my feet to be protected with those shoes. But I'm also thinking about it. I'm thinking about what it meant. When I have a meal now, I'm thinking, what do I really need to eat to stay healthy and well? And when I make the choice to eat something that came from an animal, then I have to stop and I have to acknowledge it and I have to give my thanks. Now, what's interesting is I have good friends who are vegans, and I respect that. And they're vegans for the reason of protection of animals, because of what they understand about animals. But I also now understand that plants are very much alive, and plants are intelligent. And the work of some researchers, there's a researcher in Italy named Stefano Moncoso, who documents the intelligence of plants by their capacity to solve problems in very complex ways. So life is everywhere. Mm-hmm. And so I think trying to figure out how to preserve it all is, for me, not the question. It's how to respect it all, how to honor it all, how to at least live with awareness of it.
You know, one of the most moving moments in your book, I think this was in Waking to Beauty, is when you are given a whip to use to intimidate a horse, and you decide that that's not how you want to develop a relationship with a horse. I'm wondering what horses would say about how we should develop relationships with them and with other living beings.
Well, Susanna, we domesticated horses, and that's a word that has a lot of meaning for me. We took them out of the wild long time ago, and most of them, and made them dependent on us by breaking them. That's the language that was used, training them. And now, because of that, they are in our care and they are responsibilities, except for the few that remain in the wild, and we're not treating them very well right now. We're collecting them and putting them to death, a lot of them. But at any rate, those that now are part of human culture, I think that asking them, for example, when I work with my clients and something's going on, I'll often say, well, did you ask them? Did you tell them first? So often horses are bought and sold just because they're not working out. And it turns out what I'm learning is that's really, really hard for many horses, because they have relationships with other horses that they live with. They bond, they're connected to the people they're with. And then suddenly one day they're somewhere else and they belong to someone else. They're owned by someone else. And they wonder, what happened? What did I do wrong? And so just communicating, just like what we want to do with other human beings, to communicate, this is what's going on. This is what has to happen. I'm sorry for the pain this may cause you, but this is why. Having conversations, heart-to-heart, honest talks, why can't we at least just start with that? And I think that's what they're asking for. At least from my experience, that's what they're asking for.
You also are a science fiction writer. And as you describe it, you say that you use science fiction to tweak students' moral imagination. Can you talk about that?
With ethics, when I'm teaching engineering students, sometimes they check out, you know, because a lot of conventional ethics education is around codes of behavior, like don't do this and make sure you don't lie and make sure you don't cheat. And then if you expand it out a little bit, you can take it to what we call the macroethics. So the microethics is about individual behavior, but the macroethics is more about, you know, the meaning and significance of, say, technology in the world. And so to get them to think about, to think creatively and imaginatively, science fiction takes them off the hook in a way, because it's no longer about them as individuals, and they can sort of then extrapolate beyond known reality. And when you can extrapolate beyond known reality, beyond sort of our everyday relationships with the way technology is now, then you can be more playful and more relaxed. And it's challenging for them. Like when you think about the possibilities of, for example, AI systems becoming intelligent, or robots interacting with humans in a way that humans become attached to them, et cetera, et cetera. Science fiction can take us out of the realm, and then we can talk about values and concepts and beliefs out there in that realm, and then bring it back mm-hmm. to center.
So we can imagine something other than what exists right now.
Science fiction helps us to do that, but the thing about science fiction is it's always really about the present. I mean, it appears to be about the future, but it's pulling from concerns about the present.
Can you talk about your science fiction book, Waiting in the Silence?
That was such a wonderful experience writing that book. And again, that was not intentional. I had been interviewing scientists in New York City at NYU and Columbia about their work in nanotechnology and thinking about implications of their work for the future. And that nanotechnology has to do with manipulating matter at the nanoscale, which is teeny, 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 tiny. And at the nanoscale, properties are different, like the properties of carbon are different at the nanoscale, so you can do things with them that you can't do at the macro scale. At any rate, I'd been doing these interviews for 2 days straight. I went to my hotel. I went to sleep. At about 1 a.m, I woke up. I sat up wide awake, and I thought, what am I doing awake? And I couldn't get back to sleep. And so I picked up a pen, and I just started writing. And I wasn't really thinking. I just started writing, half awake, half asleep. And then dawn came, and I thought, oh, shucks, I missed my chance to sleep. So I put the papers away and went back to work. And then months later, I found the papers, and I started reading them. And lo and behold, it was a short story set in Nantucket in the future. And the main character was a woman named Oriana, who was pregnant in a way that was quite against the dictates, the mandates of the laws of the future. And it was a time, near-term future, where climate change had wreaked havoc on the world, but so had some of our behaviors that led to serious problems of infertility. So at any rate, I turned it into a novel because I fell in love with the character Oriana, and her story really enticed me. And it's like the characters were talking through me, and that's the beauty of the imagination, if you let it do that. And she ended up having quite a fierce response against the system that was trying to manipulate her procreative life. I use that as a way of thinking about ethics in terms of where we're going with some of our technologies. And I think that that book came, the seed was planted, because I was interviewing these mostly men, actually, scientists about their work, and wondering, how are we thinking about what this work might mean for our lives in the future?
And it seems, in a way, to connect back to your work with horses, in that the people who are making the decisions also need to be thinking about the implications for everybody who's affected by those decisions, right? Including animals.
And I hope to contribute, as a scholar in my work, to that conversation. I think that's what some part of me is being called to do right now, is like, stop hiding, bring it right into the academy, right into the world of engineering, and pose these questions, because a lot of technological development, whether directly or indirectly, impacts human life as well as all life. And at this point, what we do with our technologies, what we do with our engineering, has responsibilities for the entire biosphere of all life, because it can impact all life. We're living with it. We look at the droughts and the fires and the pandemics, and we're living with the results of our actions, our consumption of technology, but also our development of it. So yeah, it is connected, Suzanne. I'm hoping to connect those dots in a better way in my writing.
Today, I've been speaking with Dr. Rosalind Byrne, who is a professor of applied ethics at the University of Virginia and the author of When Horses Whisper and also Waking to Beauty. If people want to find out more about your work, where can they go?
if you just type Rosalind Byrne, B-E-R-N-E, into a Google search, it's going to pop up all kinds of things. I also have a website, rosalindbyrne.com. That website has on it video of me talking to a horse.
Thank you so much today for being on the show.
You are kind. Thank you for your wonderful question.
I am Suzanne LeGrand, and this is KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM in Portland. And this is Radio Zine.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy jueves 30 de septiembre del 2021. YouTube eliminará los videos que difunden información errónea sobre las vacunas, ya que intensifica la represión del contenido dañino publicado durante la pandemia del coronavirus. A partir del miércoles, el sitio de transmisión de videos, que ya prohibió las falsedades de la inyección del COVID, eliminará el contenido que contenga información errónea, como afirmar que cualquier vacuna aprobada es peligrosa, causa defectos crónicos de salud o no reduce la propagación de la enfermedad. Según las pautas anteriores, la plataforma de